from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, today, one in 68 children is on the autism spectrum. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Yet despite decades of research, there is much we don't know about the disorder. We'll discuss the evolving definition, hidden history, and public perception of autism with NeuroTribe's author, Steve Silberman. He'll join us next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Defined back in 1943 as a rare disorder of childhood, today, according to the Center for Disease Control, the autistic spectrum has an estimated 1 of 68 Americans with the disorder. San Francisco author Steve Silberman is the author of NeuroTribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. And he's covered science and cultural affairs for Wired and other national magazines for over 20 years. His writing has appeared in The New Yorker and Time Magazine, Nature and Salon, and welcome him to the Forum program. Glad to have you.
Very nice to be here, Michael.
Well, let's begin with some names that really shape the whole history of autism and explain a lot of the mystery of such things as why was there a so-called epidemic in the 90s and all of that. And we go back to two figures who both sort of have Austrian lineage, Leo Kanner and Hans Asperger.
Yep. The widely accepted view of autism history is that autism was discovered by Leo Kanner. He was a child psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. In fact, he was one of the first child psychiatrists in America. And in 1943, he published that paper that you just quoted from, describing 11 children who had a certain constellation of impairments that he called autism. And that was considered the landmark discovery of autism. And a footnote to that in the widely accepted view of autism history is that a year later, this guy named Hans Asperger in Vienna came out with a paper that described four children with a similar but not quite overlapping set of challenges in daily life. What I discovered is that the notion that those two discoveries were completely independent and it was kind of considered one of the great synchronicities of 20th century medicine, and it was considered just a coincidence that they both called this condition that they were describing autism. I discovered that that was really not true and that time unfolded in a different way.
Because there was a man named George Frankl. Right?
Yes, exactly. What I discovered was that what we now call the autism spectrum was really discovered by Hans Asperger and his colleagues in Vienna in the 1930s. And Asperger's view of autism was extremely prescient. He believed that it was a condition that was primarily caused by genetics. In fact, he believed that it was caused by the interaction of multiple genes, which turns out to be true and was incredibly prescient for the 1930s to conceive of things that way. And he also conceived of it as a lifelong chronic condition that lasted from birth to death and that had a very, very broad range of presentations. So you could have a kid who was unable to speak and would probably not be able to get by in life without constant care. Or you can have a chatty adult professor of astronomy who would also be on this, what Asperger and his colleagues called the autistic continuum. So,
which often meant just not taking social cues and those sorts of things.
Exactly. And you know, not being able to read social signals in real time. And Asperger's descriptions of autistic people were very, very beautiful. But what hardly anyone seems to notice in his paper that was published in 1944 is that he said that he saw more than 200 children at all levels of ability, as well as adults. And what most people think, and it's reported in hundreds of textbooks and Wikipedia, et cetera, was that Asperger saw, quote unquote, high functioning children. And it's usually misstated that he only saw four and that Connor saw 11. And so Connor's paper sort of takes precedence. What I discovered was that, in fact, the two discoveries were not at all coincidental, that Connor did a very heroic thing, which was to help Jewish clinicians escape what was going on in Vienna in the late 1930s, and in fact, what was going on all over Germany and Austria, which was the Holocaust. And one of the clinicians that Connor rescued from the Holocaust was George Frankl, who was Asperger's chief diagnostician. And in fact, Connor's first three autistic patients were examined and evaluated by George Frankl. And not only was George Frankl in Baltimore when Connor, quote unquote, discovered autism in 1943, but so was Ani Weiss, by then Ani Weiss Frankl, who was another of Asperger's core team who came to America to escape the Holocaust and married George Frankl. So in a sense, Connor had the expertise of Asperger's clinic with him when he, quote unquote, discovered autism. But unfortunately, what happened was Connor had a very, very different and much narrower conception of autism. He conceived of it as a very, very rare form of, quote unquote, infantile psychosis.
Psychosis, yeah.
Right. And eventually he would adopt the position that it was the precursor to adult schizophrenia. And then worse than that, he eventually blamed, you know, what became known as refrigerator mothers.
That's the worst part of it.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I can remember reading Bettelheim's Joey, the Mechanical Boy. And
yep.
For so long, mothers were blamed, or parents were blamed, particularly mothers, of course, for autism. And it was dead wrong.
Yeah, it was very dead wrong. And not only that, it the effects of that theory cascaded down through the generations in a way that is not obvious, but that I talk about in my book. What is obvious is that that was a terrible thing to do to parents, because raising an autistic child is very, very challenging, particularly when there are very few resources to support the families, as there still are now very few resources. But to add to that a burden of shame and stigma and guilt, you know, I spoke to older parents whose kids had been diagnosed in the early days, and they were often told to put the kid in an institution. This was Connor's advice. Put the kid in an institution to remove the kid from the allegedly toxic family environment that had made them autistic. Quietly remove their photos from the family album and never speak of the child again.
It's heartbreaking to think about. It's just
horrible.
I mean, absolutely horrible. It actually brings tears to my eyes to think of, you know, people being led into that notion of their own culpability. But also, you suddenly see this rash of diagnoses in the 90s. Everybody's thinking, oh, this is an epidemic, you know, of autism. I certainly thought that as well. But it really was suddenly the recognition of Asperger and of the spectrum and the realization that there was a whole continuum there, that there were just differences that had to be accounted for. I mean, still in many ways an enigma when we talk about autism. There's so much that we don't understand. But suddenly there was a shift and everybody thought, oh, suddenly we have a proliferation of people who are autistic. That wasn't the case at all.
Not at all. And in fact, what happened was there was a cognitive psychologist named Lorna Wing in England who had a profoundly autistic daughter. Her daughter was not just on the spectrum, but she was a classic case of what used to be called Connor's syndrome. So it was this, you know, she was very disabled. But she knew that there were lots of families that had autistic kids who could not get access to services because Connor's definition of autism was too narrow. So she and a research colleague named Judith Gould went into a suburb of London called Camberwell to try to find cases of autism. And what they found was that there were, you know, a small number of cases of autism, as Connor defined it and would have predicted. But there were also many, many more children who had one or two or three manifestations of what Connor described, but he would not have given them a diagnosis. And so they decided that Connor's very narrow and monolithic conception of autism was wrong, and they worked with the subcommittee that was designing the criteria for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the so-called Bible of Psychiatry. They worked quietly with the subcommittee to broaden the diagnosis. And that happened in two steps in 1986 and 1994. And that's when the diagnoses started spiking, just as Lorna and Judith had intended, because they were intending to make services available to autistic people and their families who had been excluded before. So they were not surprised by the rise in diagnoses. They predicted it. But what happened? What happened was, autism experts were so used to being ignored because it was considered such a rare condition that they were just sort of chatting amongst themselves in these niche journals that hardly anyone read. No one outside of the, you know, very small circle of experts knew what had gone on with the diagnosis. Suddenly there, you know, there were all these new cases of autism, and there were, you know, much more nuanced conditions like something called PDD-NOS, or pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, which Connor would never have diagnosed as autism. And suddenly the diagnoses started going through the roof, the prevalence estimates started going through the roof, and then along came Dr. Andrew Wakefield to claim that what was causing this was not the change in the diagnostic criteria, but the MMR vaccine.
Let's talk for a moment about diagnostics, though, because that plays such a central role, as does genetics, as you indicated earlier. I mean, it used to be, you're talking about the Holocaust, they were taking those with autism and killing them,
absolutely,
on the eugenic basis of Nazis killing those with lethal injections or starvation because they were autistic. But I want to get to the fact that there's also a lot of, your book title, neurodiversity here. I mean, ADHD, dyslexia, these are all sort of part of what we understand now in the human genome. And certainly there are genetic links to, not to in any way herald eugenics here, but there are, I mean, you look at a lot of the people in Silicon Valley, so-called nerd effect in Silicon Valley, and there's
That's
a predisposition there toward autism.
In fact, the last time I was on this show was to talk about an article I wrote in 2001 called The Geek Syndrome.
I remember.
That was really the seed of this book. But, you know, in part, what
by the way, somebody took umbrage of the word geek.
I remember that. Yeah. But, I mean, geek for Wired magazine readers was a very high compliment, you know.
But it was a drunk in the circus, right?
Yeah, something like that. Or the guy who bites the head off chickens or something like that.
Ozzy Osbourne.
Right. But I do want to point out, by the way, that one of the things that I explore in the book is that Hans Asperger did something extremely heroic, which was that he protected the kids in his clinic from extermination. Because there was a secret child extermination program run by the Nazis, and in fact, for a while, headed by one of Asperger's former colleagues, which is really intense. And two of the groups that this extermination program targeted were kids with epilepsy and kids with schizophrenia. And because the autism diagnosis did not exist yet, the two diagnoses that autistic kids were most apt to end up with were epilepsy and schizophrenia. So Asperger knew that his kids were very much in danger. And so what he did was, in talking to the Nazis, he played up what he called his most promising cases and didn't really talk about
the little geniuses.
Right, exactly. He called them his little professors. And he wasn't just calling them that, and it wasn't just like some, you know, patting on the head cute thing, because he actually consulted with his quote-unquote patients, the kids in his clinic, to develop means of teaching autistic kids that were extremely prescient. And he treated them almost as equals and was certainly very interested in what they had to say, and even once wrote that the best teachers for autistic kids must figure out how to become somehow autistic, which was an amazingly prescient statement. But so Asperger protected these kids, and then despite the fact that the Gestapo came to his clinic three times to arrest him, luckily he had a sort of ace in the hole because his supervisor was one of the biggest Nazis around. And so his supervisor liked him and protected him, and Asperger was able to survive the war, although we actually destroyed his clinic. And then what happened, the reason why his work became so obscure was because Connor never mentioned Asperger once in any of the papers that he wrote about autism. And historians have puzzled over this, you know, how could Connor have not been aware of this, you know, the one competing paper that came out a year after his? And, you know, people say, well, you know, Asperger's paper was written in German. That was Connor's native language. People say, well, it was in this obscure medical journal. one that Connor cited in many papers that he wrote. So the notion that he was unaware of Asperger's work is ridiculous.
Connor just wanted all the credit. I mean, I think that's
yeah, or
obvious.
Something, or the other thing, you know, to be more kind to Connor, the thing that occurs to me is that perhaps Connor, as a Jew, believed that Asperger was collaborating with Nazis and was, you know, rightfully offended by that. That's the kind of positive spin, of, you know, that I can think of, but I don't know.
Our guest is journalist Steve Silberman. His new book is Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. And we'll talk about neurodiversity and talk about, well, the future of autism, especially in light of some recent research. But you kind of have – you make a case here, Steve. I mean, that we need to celebrate, educate, kind of welcome this whole spectrum and just recognize it just as difference.
That's true, although – by saying that, I don't want to play down the challenges that autistic people have in daily life and that parents have in daily life as well.
They're extraordinary.
They are extraordinary. It is very, very difficult to raise an autistic child, particularly when even just the ability to get a diagnosis is so hard to come by. Parents wait months for their kids to get clinically evaluated. Basically all the services available to autism families are scarce, and there's tremendous competition for them, and people actually move all across the country in search of schools that will accept their kids and services. Parents have to sue their local school boards so their kids have a right to education.
Though on the positive side, the internet has helped a lot because autistic parents can communicate with one another and can help
absolutely.
In terms of offering services and advantages.
Absolutely. In fact, the internet was probably the biggest thing that happened in the world of autism because it allowed not only parents to talk to each other, but autistic people to find each other.
And now, in fact, talk about technology. I mean, that's really – you've been the wired writer mm-hmm. all these many years. I mean, autistic kids are using iPads. There's all sorts of new ways. I mean, it used to be ham radios, I guess, but now new kinds of technology that are finding advances in autism. And let's talk about some of this new research, too, because there's new research that says that they have fewer but more creative ideas, autistic children. This is in the Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders. They, for example, they give them items like they give them a brick or they give them a paperclip, and they'll come up with these ideas. You know, and I don't mean to romanticize it or anything, but it's really in many ways exceptional.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what's interesting is that if you read my book, actually, but if you're very familiar with autism history, you see these kind of, you know, this news story of the week about autism, you see it as an expression of some dynamic that unfolded before in autism history. And so Asperger, actually, in his original paper, talked a lot about the astonishing creativity of the kids in his clinic. And one of my favorite little moments in Asperger's writing is he asks an autistic kid if he is religious. And the kid replies very politely, "I don't like to say I'm not religious. I just don't have any proof of God." And he saw that kind of skepticism as crucial to the minds of a scientist. And so he predicted that the kids in his clinic would, some of them anyway, were naturally inclined to become scientists because they were skeptical in the same way that scientists are.
What got you so interested in autism?
Well, I entered the autism world in an extremely unusual way, which is that I believe it was 2000, I was on a boat in Alaska with more than 100 computer programmers. And I asked sort of the star of this quote-unquote geek cruise if I could come to his house in Silicon Valley and interview him. And he said, "Yeah, sure. I should tell you, we have a profoundly autistic daughter." And so then I was writing a profile of another technologically adept family in Silicon Valley. The patriarch of the family had built the first computer in Israel, actually. And I asked the sister-in-law of the woman I was writing about if I could come visit her at her house in Silicon Valley. And she said, "Yeah, sure. We have an autistic daughter." And I thought that was very odd. You know, I didn't know much about autism.
Odd, because the odds are there are more males with autism disproportionately.
That's true, although we don't know if that's just because we don't know what to look for yet. But that's actually a subject of great controversy in autism research world. But anyway, so I was telling that story about that weird coincidence in a cafe in San Francisco in my neighborhood. And a woman at the next table suddenly blurted out, "Oh, my God, do you realize what's happening?" And I said, "What?" And she said, I'm a special education teacher in Silicon Valley. There's an epidemic of autism in Silicon Valley. Something terrible is happening to our children. And so it was like the hairs on the back of my neck stood on end. And also my reportorial instincts, you know, were engaged. And so I thought, I got to look into this. And so I ended up writing that article about autism in Silicon Valley called The Geek Syndrome. But, you know, what happened was as time went on, and I talked mostly about genetics in that article, but as time went on, I kept getting email from autistic people and their families for like 10 years, which, you know, in the ephemeral world of magazine writing is very unusual. And what was happening was the parents were no longer, you know, profoundly concerned about what had caused their child's autism because they were dealing day to day with the lack of services. And I thought, I ended up thinking that I had sort of missed the story by focusing so narrowly on the dynamics of autism in high-tech communities. And so that's why I wrote Neurotribes.
And Neurotribes, again, is subtitled The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Talk about that future, because I suppose it really is tied to the Genome Project. And we know now that, the brain of an autistic child or an autistic adult, for that matter, and the symptoms do, I think, improve over time, as you point out in your book. They are often lifelong, usually lifelong. But the serotonin levels and the neurotransmitter levels are abnormal in autistic people.
Well, you know, what you'll find if you read stories over the years is that, you know, every couple of years a scientist announces that they have found, you know, what could be a biomarker for autism, too much white matter, you know, and then 2 years later you read too little white matter. And so actually, you know, we still haven't zeroed in on exactly what the biomarkers for autism are. There is still no brain scan or blood test that can diagnose somebody. People are diagnosed on the basis of subjective clinical observations and a set of standardized clinical instruments, but it's still about observing people and about behavior and social context.
So we don't. I thought we were able to quantify to some extent these abnormal levels of serotonin.
It's not diagnostic yet. There are some findings.
A lot of subjectivity involved. Yeah. I recognize that. But, yeah. But what about the genes?
Here's the thing.
It's empirical stuff on that, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, there is. But here's the thing. You know, back in when I wrote Geek Syndrome, a lot of parents were telling me, oh, yes, they're going to discover the autism gene. Well, they did, except it turned out that there were more than 1,000 candidate genes that contribute to autism. Not only that, each autistic person is genetically quite unique, as one of the big autism geneticists said. And there's a saying in the autistic community, if you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. And that turns out also to be true for molecular geneticists.
Again, Steve Silverman is our guest. He'll be speaking tonight at Booksmith in San Francisco at 7:30, and he's with us here. And I'm going to invite those of you listening to join us. By the way, there's an article in The Washington Post that just appeared today called A New Study, Autism, Creativity, and Divergent Thinking May Go Hand in Hand. Lots of new research and certainly probably lots of questions from you and lots of experiences, too, since we're talking about something that falls along the spectrum, as I said, with 1 in 68 children. If you have questions or comments, feel free to join us. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we welcome your calls. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join us again. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Other ways you can communicate your questions or comments to us, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. We'll hear from you when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Steve Silberman, journalist and author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. He'll be speaking tonight at the Booksmith in San Francisco at 7:30 p.m. And today there are 1 in 68 children on the autism spectrum. That's according to the CDC, Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And despite years of research, there's much we simply don't know about this disorder. It remains mysterious in so many ways. And we're talking about the evolving definition, the hidden history, the public perception, and much more, and certainly getting a lot of responses as I expected. Here's a listener who writes, a psychiatrist diagnosed me with Asperger's syndrome in 1991 before that term was deprecated in favor of autism spectrum disorder, or had been widely assumed by people taking internet quizzes looking for an excuse for being habitually rude. Two questions. One, actually, this is mark zero. I've wondered if Dr. Asperger created a new category because people diagnosed as autistic in 1944 Austria were in danger of being murdered by their government, along with the insane and the slow. Is there any evidence of that? And
no, actually, this is what's so interesting. The concept and the term Asperger syndrome was invented by Lorna Wing, the cognitive psychologist that I talked about earlier, as a diagnosis that did not contain the word autism. Because the term autism, because of those decades of parent blaming, was so stigmatized that she felt that if she could coin a term that described, you know, an area of the spectrum without using the word autism, that parents might embrace it rather than rejecting it. The other thing is that Connor's definition of autism was generally not applied to adults at all. And she wanted to create a category that could also apply to adults, because something that almost everyone forgets is that when Temple Grandin, who's sort of the archetypal, adult autistic person.
The poster woman for autism.
Right, exactly. When she made her debut with her book Emergence, she was defined in the introduction of Emergence as a recovered autistic person, because it was considered impossible, the notion that an autistic child could grow up and get a PhD and become a professor of animal science and a leading industrial designer in her field. So she was billing herself as recovered. And, you know, she very quickly realized that she wasn't recovered. She was an adult autistic person.
Sort of like what they say in AA, you're an alcoholic, you're always an alcoholic. Right. Here's the same listener writes, with age and I assume lower energy, I find myself, I think the term would be decompensating. I am less able to deal with people while appearing halfway normal. I think I'm less good at inferring social cues. Is this commonplace?
A lot of people have told me that, you know, as they get older, you know, in some ways they get better at sort of navigating a world that is basically foreign to them. But in other ways, you know, they face more serious challenges. So things go up and down. I think I might be decompensating myself as a neurotypical. But anyway.
Well, here's Beth who writes, as we were talking about this whole controversy about are the numbers of men disproportionate to those of women? She says, we've been discussing neurotribes on Facebook, and one question that comes up a lot is why we women with autism are not talked about more. Males may make up a higher proportion of those on the autism spectrum, but there are a lot of females, and many of us are successful in science, high tech, art, etc. Why don't we hear more about autistic women?
Well, oh, I completely agree.
Well, Temple Grandin certainly changed that for a while, but she's right.
She's only one person, though.
Yeah. I mean, Beth is right. Chris writes, there was a wonderful Vicky Mayberry story on 60 Minutes several years ago that was a breakthrough training for autistic kids. A mother in India found a way to communicate with her severely autistic child with flashcards. However, instead of showing flashcards at a rate of 1/5 seconds, she showed them at the breakneck speed of 3 seconds. The fast pace totally held the autistic child's interest and allowed them to grow. And as a result, her severely autistic child learned to read, do math, create art, and understand social structure. The amazing part of the story was that the child was then interviewed. The child explained how much he loved his mother for freeing him from his own mind, allowing him to communicate, love, and contribute to society. The story ended with this beautiful and heart-wrenching poem that the kid had written. This is breakthrough insight that most are still unaware of. And we asked, by the way, on social media, if you or a loved one are on the autistic spectrum, what's your biggest worry? What are you celebrating? And Del Dip replied, having a police officer mistake autistic behavior as threatening as the biggest concern or biggest fear. We'll hear from probably more listeners on that. And let's hear from our listeners. Let's begin with you, Paul. Good morning.
Oh, hello. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
I am an Asperger's adult. I teach social skills for a living, and I have an answer and a personal theory based on research for your female question.
Good. Let's hear it.
Basically, the theory is
whoops, we've lost your connection, Paul. We're going to have to leave that in suspense until you get a better line from you, but thank you for the call. Let me go to another caller in Sebastopol. Jake, hi.
Hi. I wanted to share that I have a 24-year-old daughter. She's off the spectrum. She's been off the spectrum for several years. I chelated her from heavy metals, mostly mercury and chemicals. I did a lot of behavior in educational tutoring, 40 hours a week, lots of volunteers. I wanted to also add that several doctors have been killed, Dr. Bradstreet and his fellows, for discovering nigellase in vaccines on their GC-MAF discoveries. That GC-MAF is very critical to the immune system, and that nigellase is an antagonist. And I think what the problem was is that they discovered nigellase in vaccines. And I'm going to take this off.
Steve, I'm coming.
I wish you and your daughter the best.
Yeah, so do I. Thank you for the call. I think we have Paul back to get his answer to the mystery of why we don't hear more about. Paul, I hope we have a good line with you now.
Yeah. Sorry, the phone is a little old and it's not quite up to date yet.
All right. We can hear you fine now. Go ahead.
Basically, it is all external Asperger's models are based on outward behavior, and that is very male in the pro-normal gender roles. Female gender roles are different. Female women learn to pass. They learn to fit in better, and they learn to not be so obvious. My model is based on depression and social isolation. You break it down between biological and social causes. In the end, you find a female spectrumite if it's social cause. Because the gender roles make them able to pass better and not get so noticed.
That's, I think, a worthy theory. What do you think, Steve Silverman?
I absolutely agree. I think that research into women on the spectrum is really only beginning. And that, women are trained, unlike men, to sort of fade into the background and be demure and script their comments to go along with their peers. And so I think it's to say it's easier for women to pass would be a misstatement, because it's not necessarily easier on them. But I think that autistic boys are noticed because, certain kinds of aggression in boys is rewarded, actually. And so I think we're only beginning to unravel the knot of gender and autism.
And let me thank the caller. Paul, thank you for that. And we go to another caller, Craig from Oakland. Morning.
Good morning. I have an autistic son. He's now 37 years old. It seems to me that a lot of the rhetoric, and it's happened on this program, that you speak of autistic children, autistic kids. These kids grow up, and they become autistic adults. You don't get over autism. It's a lifelong condition, and it seems to me that we should speak of autistic people. These autistic people have severe problems in adulthood with respect to resources, where they're going to live, whether they are going to ever be employed. My son will never be employed. He has an assisted job disassembling electronic parts for 4 hours a day. He likes that job, and so he goes to it. But it seems to me that if we were to speak of autistic adults and the needs that they have and their resources, that we would serve the community.
No, Craig, I think you're absolutely right. Thank you for that. I would heartily agree with what you say. I guess part of the reason children are spoken of largely is because so many of these studies were done with children.
That's true. And also, by the way, I have to say I could not agree more with what you just said. And in fact, I wrote an op-ed in the LA Times yesterday making that exact point. And a truly shocking report came out in June from the Government Accountability Office that reported that the research into improving the lives of autistic adults has actually gone down in recent years. And one of the reasons why that is because the obsession with vaccines helps render previous generations of autistic people invisible. And in fact, Jenny McCarthy once said, there were no autistic adults. It's all now. Well, I know many autistic adults myself, and I completely agree with you. We have to stop talking about autistic children, autistic children, autistic children. We should talk about autistic people. And if you think about it, there are more autistic adults than there are autistic children, and they're still virtually invisible to our society, and there are very few services and resources available to them. And it is one of the main things that I want to change with my book, actually. I make that point over and over again in my book.
Are you actually questioning the scientific expertise of Jenny McCarthy?
Indeed.
All right, let me thank the caller. Actually, apropos of what we're talking about, here's John who writes, there's been a lot of discussion about the change in the rate of autism. This is difficult to determine since over the years there have been different definitions, different diagnostic methods, and increased attention to the problem. In 2007, the British National Service Health Service conducted a random population survey of autism spectrum disorder, dividing the population into young, 16 to 44, rate 1.1%, middle age, 45 to 74, rate 0.9%, and old, 75 plus, rate 0.8%. It concluded that the rate was about 1%, and a slight downward trend with increasing age appeared to be evident but was not significant, and no significant variation in rate by broad age group was evident. Since a fixed definition and diagnostic criterion was used, the survey gives good evidence that the rate of ASD has not changed significantly over time.
I love that study. That's Terry Bruges' study, actually, and I saw him present on that study. And, you know, it is so taken for granted, particularly in America, that the autism rates are spiking, and there have actually been a couple of studies, including a huge study in Sweden, that suggests exactly the opposite, that autism rates have remained stable. So that actually, you know, that's not just some interesting factoid. It presents a profound challenge for our society.
It means we have to do better diagnostics, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. We have to do better diagnostics. And we also have to start thinking more about the fate of autistic adults.
In fact, I'm looking at another email from Martha who says, thank you for today's hour on autism. Two cautions. Autism spectrum disorders are not limited to children, of course. We grow up and live with the condition all our lives. Sensory issues are huge underlying factors in much of what non-autistic individuals label as social skills deficits. My sensorium is continually overwhelmed by my brain's inability to screen out extraneous input like the sounds, smells, and tactile sensations that others are not even aware of. My amygdala keep reading these as threats, and I am suspended in a never-ending state of flight or fight syndrome. It's pretty hard to be social when in that state.
That's actually a beautiful description. Thank you.
Thank you indeed. And let me go to another caller here. We'll bring in Benjamin. Morning.
Good morning. Hi.
Hi.
People on the spectrum are often portrayed as in need of help or victims. I'm 20. I'm in college. I ship out on Friday. My autism has not only given me incredible intellectual capability and curiosity, but it's also taught me why effective communication is so important. How can we shift the narrative to us, being autistic people, being people with different skill sets? How can we get the word out that autism can be one's greatest weakness and strength?
I agree. I think that's a very important message. And in fact, that is the message of neurodiversity, which is that the diversity of styles of human cognition should be celebrated rather than pathologized. A very quick definition of neurodiversity is great minds don't think alike necessarily. And there are lots of different styles of cognition, and we have to stop pathologizing different ones, deal with the real serious challenges that certain forms of neurodiversity present to people and their families, and embrace that diversity as one of the strengths of our society.
And let me thank Benjamin for his call. We'll go to more calls in a moment. I want to go to a couple of emails here. A listener named Scott who says, as a gay man and an Aspie, I think it means he has Asperger's, I've noticed that among my Aspie friends, there seems to be an unusual number of gay men. And among my gay friends, I've noticed an unusual number of Aspies. Is this just my imagination, or is there an association, or has there been a study?
Well, I don't think it's just your imagination, because I've noticed the same thing, or something perhaps a little more nuanced, which is a friend of mine is a sociologist. And she asked autistic people to describe their own sexual orientations. And what was so interesting was that many of them were kind of non-binary about the gay-straight thing. They embraced sexual fluidity and a lack of strict definitions between gay and straight. And I thought that was very, very interesting. I've seen that a lot among autistic young people.
Maybe you can help us with this. Catherine writes on Facebook, the woman who chelated her daughter and talked about doctors being murdered is spreading misinformation. Chelation therapy is not appropriate treatment for autism and can be very dangerous. Do you know about that?
I absolutely agree.
Yeah. Jorge says many of the rampage killers have been reported to have been treated for autism or Asperger's syndrome. Why do many of these killers have this syndrome? Does this diagnosis make them not culpable for their actions?
That's actually also misinformation. I read the document that he's referring to, and it's BS, really. It's mostly bad media reporting because, you know, like Joe Scarborough speculates that, you know, every spree killer is autistic. It's not true.
And we go to more of your calls. Let me go to Chris next. Chris, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Good morning, Michael. My daughter is on the autism spectrum, and she's a teenager, and she's having a very defiant phase. And I'm wondering if this is common, that teens on the autism spectrum are even more defiant than a neurotypical teen. I'd be curious to hear about that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
Have any advice for him? Any sage wisdom?
Yeah. Pick up a book called Thinking Person's Guide to Autism, which was written by parents. It's full of excellent advice for parents.
Good luck to you, Chris. And let's talk about these parents for a moment, because some of them are nothing short of heroic.
Absolutely. You know, people, especially because there are so few resources for families, people, you know, women often end up quitting their jobs to become sort of case managers for their children. People have had to prevail in the face of medical models of autism that blamed them. The struggles of autism parents are one of the things that I chronicle in the book. I go very in depth into the struggles of one particular family. It's the parents of autistic kids and autistic people themselves are all heroes.
Again, we're talking about autism with Steve Silverman. His book is Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Here's Dorothy. Dorothy, join us.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
Hi, I'm a school psychologist and have had a variety of experiences with autistic kids and somewhat familiar with the research. And to me, what makes the most sense of all the hypotheses that I've heard of, I keep trying to reconcile things like savant abilities and also the fact that the spectrum shades off into just very, very bright people, like Einstein, you know, for example. And I understand that there is some evidence that the problem may be that there's an over-proliferation of neuronal connections early on, sometimes called brain overgrowth, and then there is insufficient what they call neuronal pruning, which is the essence of how people learn behavior. I wonder if your guest has any knowledge whether this line of research is going on and if there's any evidence.
Yeah, I believe that's Eric Korshain's hypothesis. I think he's at UCLA, and it's, you know, one of the hypotheses that is still active and has not been disproven. I think it's interesting. I have to say, I don't spend much time in my book talking about theories of autism causation or biological theories of autism. I talk mostly about the social context in which the diagnosis developed and evolved. And I ended up learning a lot that I never would have learned if I had only focused on, you know, exactly what's going on in the autistic brain. There are other books about that, including one by Temple Grandin called The Autistic Brain.
And Dorothy, we thank you for the call. Actually, she mentioned the word savant. Online comment from a listener says, as a data point, my mother's parents had friends with a savant daughter born in Canada in the 1930s. When we visited, she sat and did not speak, but she could play the piano beautifully.
Yep. Not uncommon, actually.
Here's Adam who tweets, could autism be a way our modern bodies and minds are trying to evolve, our nature trying to cope with technological advancement?
I think it's a mistake to see autism as a modern phenomenon and some kind of historical aberration. I actually think that's one of the biggest traps in the world.
It's been with
us
a long time. I mean,
yeah, it has. Yeah. And there are beautiful descriptions of autistic kids from the 19th century by the great British clinician J. Langdon Down. And when you see it, I mean, he writes about even things that are considered completely modern by the anti-vaccine movement, like so-called regressive autism. This has been a part of the human community for a very long time.
And Rick is our next caller. Rick, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yeah, hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I just read your op-ed piece. And very interesting because it can be applied to a bunch of other conditions and diseases. But the reason I'm calling is I'm a social entrepreneur and graduate of Chicago Booth, and I recently saw an article in their magazine about a company called Autonomy West, which hires and has been very successful over the last 2 years in hiring people on the autistic spectrum. And it was started by a guy who actually teaches at Chicago, who was the former president of Sears Marketing, had an autistic kid. as a social entrepreneur, it seemed like a great idea. I have some good friends who have a brilliant kid on the with Asperger's on the spectrum, can't get hired. And now we're talking directly to Friedman and Autonomy Works, and we're looking to see if we can set up an Autonomy Works West. And I'd just like to connect with you, Mr. Silverman, and because it seems to go straight to what your op-ed piece is about.
I'm not hard to find on the web. That's actually, there are several companies that are doing that, including a company called Specialistern, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, that hires programmers on the spectrum and people working in the technical field. What's so interesting is that one of the things that they do is they don't force autistic people to do things that they're naturally not good at to get the job. So many jobs depend on delivering the impression that you're a good people person and a good team player. Well, most people on the spectrum are not good people or good team players, but they can be damn good at what they do. And so the hiring process at Specialistern, one of the things that they have programmers do is to build Lego Mindstorm robots, which plays on the traditional strengths of what Asperger called autistic intelligence, instead of playing against some of the social problems that autistic people have. So hiring autistic people will require us to find new ways of thinking about how people fit in and work together. And I think that's going to be a very fruitful challenge for our society.
And Rick, we thank you for the call. We'll go to more calls in a moment. I want to go to some emails, though. Janet writes, dovetailing off Rick's call, it's very difficult to raise funds for services for adults. When my son, a picture of his cute smiling face would open doors to donors. Now he is just cute, says his mother, but the stubble beard just doesn't have the same effect on philanthropic foundations. I love what I do, working with autistic teens and adults, but we need more emphasis put on the support and creation of services that are geared to the abilities of autistics, not just their impairments.
Absolutely.
Rosie writes, one of the biggest issues families with children that are deemed high-functioning autistic is services. I won't go into my full story, but we'll say that there is a gap in services. My child is deemed not deficient enough, and therefore trying to get services is impossible. We've been trying to get him some intense behavior therapy, but instead of helping me, CPS tells me the only way they will is if I abuse my son or if I take him to the police station and tell them I cannot take care of him. Can you imagine the heartbreak that would happen if I were to take my beautiful son to the police station and tell them I don't want him? What kind of crazy world do we live in where that is the only way a family can get help? Something needs to be done. We need help.
I absolutely agree. And that is one of the reasons why I really avoid using the terms high functioning and low functioning in my book, because basically so-called high functioning people are often facing more challenges and struggles than is obvious, but it's all internal. And low functioning people often have more talents and gifts than is obvious. So I think both terms are deficient in that way, and that it's not a very useful way to think about autistic people.
And here's Mary. Mary, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. My son is in high school, and he's diagnosed with either high functioning and mild autism. And I find as he goes on in school that he can't produce the work. He's very intelligent, but he can't produce the work. It's confounding to him, and the school district isn't helping. And I'm wondering, is that the norm? Am I, missing something?
So many parents have told me about similar situations. That's why families sometimes have to move around to find the right school for their kids. It sounds like your school district is failing you, unfortunately.
Well, I wish you good luck and hope that you can find better assistance, Mary. And I thank you for the call. I want to get another caller on. David from San Leandro, welcome.
Hi. I have undiagnosed autism, I know, because I know myself. But I've often survived pretty well. I'm high functioning through my abilities. I play the piano, I'm a programmer, and things like that. People find respect for me. But now I'm getting older. I'll be 60 soon, and some of these abilities are going away. Any advice for older autistic people to get by?
It's so interesting to me that that this has come up, you know, several times in this program. Obviously, that's an area of research that needs to be done. You know, I'm not qualified to give you advice about what to do about that. But what I am qualified to say is that I really feel like the fate of autistic adults has been virtually ignored, particularly in this country. It's not so bad in England. But please, if you're an academic researcher who wants a promising area of study, please start looking at the lives and the life courses of autistic adults to figure out ways that we can support them as they go through these changes, as you're going through now.
And if it's any comfort to you, David, even those of us who are non-autistic begin to feel failure in our abilities as we age. But good luck to you, and I appreciate your call. Here's Doug, who writes, while Steve's insights on spectrum folks is very welcome, I think his acceptance policy really extends to a wide range of folks that are somehow different. I'd like to hear more about that. And that's in your title again, neurodiversity.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, I mean, I hopefully we can create a societal model that embraces different kinds of minds. There is an autistic person named Zosia Zaks who once said, "We need all hands on deck to right the ship of humanity." And I think it's definitely true as we face these kind of global crises of climate change and income disparity, et cetera. I think we need many different kinds of minds tackling these problems.
And lots of swabbing of that deck, too.
Exactly.
Steve, thank you. Good to have you with us on Forum.
Thank you. It was wonderful, Michael. Thank
Appreciate
you.
Appreciate being with you. Steve Silberman, again, is a journalist and author of NeuroTribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. You can hear him this evening and meet him at Booksmith in San Francisco at 7:30 p.m. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online. We invite you to do that, kqed.org/forum. Tomorrow we'll be back with you. We're going to talk about China and the global economy in the opening hour tomorrow. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, Vinnie Tong, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zolt. Interns are LaToya Tools and Jeremy Siegel. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.